Support comes from Ohio University's Voinovich School of Leadership and Public Service, a proud member of Ohio University's Health Collaborative, with the Heritage College of Osteopathic Medicine and the College of Health Sciences and Professions. We are partnering with local providers and communities to improve public health. Information is available at ohio.edu/Voinovich-school.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Jazzed About Work, where we talk about everything that might have an impact in your career. I'm your host, Bev Jones, author of Find Your Happy at Work. And our guest today is a widely respected attorney and my dear friend, Arlene Leland. She recently retired from a long government career, including more than two decades as Associate General Counsel for Civil Rights, Labor, and Employment at one of the largest federal units, the Department of Agriculture. Arlene will tell us about her life and career path, starting with her modest beginning as the child of a teen mother in Mississippi. She'll describe how hard work, strong values, and connection with other people helped build her career and brought her multiple honor awards from both the USDA Secretary and the President of the United States. Arlene says she knows what it's like to be the only person of color in the room, and that experience strengthened her belief that we should never treat people as invisible. We also talk about the current crisis surrounding some DEI and EEO programs, and Arlene shares tips for creating inclusion and diversity policies that will make your team stronger. Arlene, I am so excited to have you here today. As you know, I've been watching your career for a really long time, and I want our listeners to know that I want to disclose that not only are we friends, but for a long time, I was your coach. And so I got a unique upfront opportunity to observe your amazing career. So now you're retired from that job, and you're doing all kinds of exciting things. And I want you here to tell your story and, share a little bit about what it's like to be a leader in a huge organization like USDA. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. And let me say this before we start. I have not done a podcast where I was the focus of the discussion. And so for some reason, I thought I was going to be on camera. And did I not put on lipstick this morning just for this? Did I not put on lipstick? And so when I was informed that this would not be a visual medium, I said I could have saved that. I could have saved that lipstick for another time. But that's okay. That's okay.
Well, thank you for forgiving me, but I know your schedule enough to know that you're going to find plenty of other opportunities to put your lipstick on.
That application.
Because a lot is happening around your life.
Yes, yes. In fact, I participated in a CNN panel discussion on Monday that was discussing the Divine Nine organizations and how they will be supporting the Harris campaign. And since I am a member of Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated, which is also the sorority of Madam Vice President Kamala Harris, I was very excited to be selected to participate.
Well, actually, one of the things I was going to ask you about is your role, your relationship with Alpha Kappa Alpha. I know one of the things that has helped to shape your career is your amazing ability to make friends everywhere you go. You're a master networker. But I think since college, it's your sorority has played a big role in that. But before we get into that, let me step away and let's go back to the beginning. As I said in the introduction, you were and are, but you were a big-time lawyer at USDA. You were general counsel for employment and EEO and all kinds of things that don't show up in your title. And it's a huge organization, but you didn't start out your life thinking you're going to have a career like that, did you? Would you tell us a little bit about yourself as a kid and how you kind of worked your way to this great job you had and what happened along the way?
Well, first of all, Bev, I'm flattered that you described me as the general counsel. I was the
associate general counsel. Sorry.
Of the Civil Rights, Labor, and Employment Law Division at USDA from 2001 until 2024, January. And I started in rural Mississippi. I was born in Oxford, Mississippi. Actually, I was born in Sardis, Mississippi, in the Hartley Colored People's Clinic. That's what it says on my birth certificate. Dr. Hartley was one of the white doctors who birthed black babies, colored babies. So I was born in the Hartley Colored People's Clinic in 1954. And my mother was 16. She was a teen mother. My father was 21. My mother finished the 10th grade. My father finished the sixth grade. So my beginnings were very humble. People often look at me and they look at my success and they say, oh, Miss Leland, you know, because I mentor young people everywhere I go. Oh, Miss Leland, you got it going on. Miss Leland, you drive that Cadillac and wear them pretty clothes. And I tell them, you don't know where I come from. And I have to give them, I have to start. I have to go back to the very beginning and let them know I started in rural Mississippi. Now, my parents divorced and my mother moved north, N-O-F-F. I always tell people north for a better life. And we moved north, N-O-F-F, to Gary, Indiana. And in Gary, Indiana, my mother worked two jobs. She was so proud of the fact that she never spent a day on welfare in her life. That was her claim to fame. That and the fact that she had four children. And she had four diplomas, two college degrees, one law degree, and one master's. Of course, those were the degrees that her children earned, but she owned them. And so I started very modestly and through hard work, and I will emphasize this, hard work got me where I got. And it wasn't DEIA. Because DEIA stands for definitely earned it. Okay? That's what DEIA stands for. I definitely earned it. I was valedictorian of my high school class of over 600. I went to Brown University, Ivy League institution. I was one of three or four people in my Poli-Sci 101 class that had 300 people in it. I was like, there were like three people of color sitting in there. It was a rude awakening for me, but hard work. I left Brown University. I was in the honors program for history. I went to GW Law School, one of 12 who graduated out of a class of over 460. And so I've always been someone who's been a trailblazer, someone who's had to work harder than anyone else to achieve, because I knew I wouldn't achieve if I didn't, you know, that hard work ethic. And that came from my mother. My mother always told me, she said, if you work hard in America, you can get anything you want. She said, but you got to work hard. Nobody's going to give it to you. So when I started out of law school at the Department of Labor, Office of the Solicitor. And my first mentor was a Jewish white man named Bart Whittem. And he was phenomenal. I often tell people, you know, women of color, well, you may not find a woman of color in your organization that's high enough to mentor you and help you. You may have to look to a white man, and that's okay. And you should look to them. And Bart Whittam saw something in me. I don't know what he saw in me. Maybe he saw the enthusiasm, the eagerness to learn. But I started my career with him. I left there. I went to the EEOC. I was an administrative judge there for 8 years, which was very good for me because I needed to see how the process works. I needed to see at Department of Labor, I was defending against discrimination. At the EEOC, I was adjudicating. I was the arbiter. I got to hear both sides and then decide whether or not there had been discrimination. I left there and I went to the Department of Treasury and the Office of the Chief Counsel, where I was one of two people of color. And I was there at Treasury, Bureau of Engraving and Printing for 9-10 years. And they didn't promote me, even though they promised it. I worked really, really hard. They sent me to Fort Worth, Texas, to stand up the legal office down there. In 1997, they built a currency facility, the Fort Worth Currency Facility, only the second place in the United States that prints currency. And they told me, Arlene, if you stand up this office, we'll promote you to a GS-15. And so I went down there. I left my family, friends, my church, my dog here in D.C., and I went down there for 18 months and stood up that office. It was one of the most challenging experiences of my life because Fort Worth is a different place. It's, it's maybe not accustomed, at least not in 1997, to seeing a accomplished professional Black woman. And so let me tell you a funny story. One day I was at the gas station because I had to drive. I was in Fort Worth down at the Worthington Hotel. And I had to drive every day out to the facility. The facility is about 20 minutes outside of Fort Worth proper. And I stopped at the gas station and I was got out to pump some gas. And this gentleman, this lovely older white gentleman, was watching me. And I smiled and he looked at me with a very quixotic face, like, what is she doing here? And so, I was dressed, of course, professionally in a suit, had my briefcase. And he said, young lady. And I am going to imitate exactly what he said.
Okay.
What parts are you from? Parts, P-A-R-T-S. And I turned to him and I smiled. I said, well, I'm from part Mississippi and part Indiana and part D.C. What you doing around here? I said, I'm going out to the new currency facility. Well, what do you do out there? I said, sir, I'm a lawyer. The look on his face. And then I pranced inside to pay for my gas.
Uh-huh.
Those kinds of experiences,
I've had those
all my life. All my life, I've had those experiences. And
well,
so
let me, can I just interrupt
yes.
here with a question? Because I, we'll get back to wherever you want to go. But I know that, as I said earlier, you are an incredible networker. And you get a lot of support from your church community, from your sorority community, from your work community. The idea of you going there by yourself and not only leaving your dog behind, which is dreadful, but not having those supportive communities that are so helpful. How did you deal with that? Did you just go around creating another community, or what did you do when you were so isolated?
Yes, I did. There was a Black gentleman down there in the Office of Security. And I asked him, I said, where do you go to church? And he says, well, I go to the Potter's House, the big church, T.D. Jakes's church. And I said, well, where's it located? He said, well, it's in Dallas. I said, well, Dallas ain't far. I got in that car and I drove to the Potter's house that Sunday morning. And I worshiped at the Potter's house for Sunday, several Sundays, until I was able to meet a woman from the U.S. Attorney's Office named Maggie. And Maggie said, well, I worship, and she worshiped at a church right there in Fort Worth. And I started attending her church. And I attended her church for the entire 16 to 18 months I was in Fort Worth. But Maggie also is an AKA. So see, that hooked me up with another group. So see, I was able to use my religion, my Christian beliefs, and my sorority affiliation to create a new network while I was down there, isolated from all that I knew in Washington, D.C.
My sense, my observation of you is that not only do you have all of these groups where you're very active and have a lot of support, when I go to lunch with you, you know the server's name, you'd probably know where they're from, you kind of have met somebody who's a friend of a friend as you're walking by the table, you are always alert to connect with other people. And lots of times it's people who may look like they need somebody to chat with. That's sort of part of your ethic, isn't it? To be alert to people, not people who could help you necessarily, but people who are needing to connect.
First of all, Bev, you know me. I come from a modest beginning, and I have not forgotten from whence I came. And so I don't see people as invisible. My mother worked in the housekeeping department for Holiday Inn. My mother worked in the housekeeping department at a bank. Okay. My mother worked at a bakery. Okay. I treat everyone like they could be my mother, and I wouldn't want you to be dismissive of her. You know, I make eye contact. I make it a point to ask people about their families. If I see someone, and you know, my famous greeting at USDA every morning, they say, good morning, Miss Leland, how are you? And my famous saying was, I won't complain. Well, see, people know in the Baptist community, I won't complain is a very famous gospel song. And so when I say I won't complain, they'll say, neither will I, won't he do it? And so that connection, immediately, I know they're a person of faith. And so I said, where do you worship at? And they'll tell me. And I say, oh, your pastor so-and-so. And so that immediate connection. So the next time I see that person, they're comfortable talking to me. They know that they can speak to me and I will greet them with a smile. They know that I want to hear about their son who is a freshman at Virginia State or a freshman at Bowie State or the daughter that got a scholarship to Tennessee State, a full scholarship. And so they want to share that good news with me because they know I care. And I think that's been very instrumental in my success in life is that
I want to change gears a little bit here because of course we want to get into EEO and all of those kinds of issues, which are sort of a
my
mess
passion.
Right now. They're your passion. And I think that we need to focus on this a little bit because there's so much confusion out there. I will note that you retired in January. You had wonderful parties that many people threw for you, acknowledging your extraordinary contributions. And since then, you've had people coming to you and saying, Ms. Leland, we need to have your help on this EEO question, or we need this. And you're wanting to be cautious because you do want to be retired, but there's a lot of demand for your knowledge. And I was thinking that it's partly just innate for you. It's not just because you're a lawyer that you understand concepts like equity. I think it's what strikes me every time we talk about some of these issues is you said, I don't see people as invisible. And in a way, isn't that part of what all of these programs are trying and should do to acknowledge every single person has a right to be treated well and with care?
I want people to stop using the word equity, and I want them to make it synonymous with opportunity. Because for some reason, many of my white brothers and sisters, when they hear equity, they get afraid. They feel like, well, if we have equity, then I won't have an opportunity. But equity is opportunity, equal opportunity for everyone. And that's women, men, persons with abilities and disabilities, persons regardless of your religion or even if you're an atheist. Equity means you get an equal opportunity. It means that who you are at your core would not be held against you, and that you will get an equal opportunity to achieve the American dream. It's about everybody having a seat at the table and not just one particular group. We need diversity, and people are afraid of the word diversity. Well, diversity means different. It means different ideas, different views, and we should all want to have different ideas at the table so that we can make the best solution for everybody, something that helps everyone. And that is so important. The Department of Agriculture, and I don't speak for agriculture because I'm no longer there, so I do not speak for them. But the Department of Agriculture is the third largest government agency in the federal bureaucracy. Over 100,000 permanent employees and something like 30,000 seasonal employees. And the Department of Agriculture just isn't about farming. It's about food insecurity. The Department of Agriculture oversees the food stamp program. That is a huge, multi-billion dollar program. And 80% of the people on food stamps are our white brothers and sisters. Although I know everybody wants to have the welfare queen, that's who they roll out. But no, I want people to understand that those programs help everybody. The Forest Service, saving our forest lands so that we can have a beautiful America. USDA oversees that through the Forest Service. And, broadband. Yeah. People wanting to be able to communicate on the internet, rural development, rural business, all of that, rural utilities, all of that is under the Department of Agriculture. So it's not just about farming, which is extremely important in our economy that we support our farmers, but it's the Department of Agriculture's about a lot more and an awful lot more.
There's so many things to balance, and so many people who have sometimes been left out because of the way their brains work or because of their background as a vet or for a whole lot of reasons. There are many people who have bumped into barriers and exclusion. And I know when you were leading these issues at USDA, you treated everybody with the same kind of respect. And that's kind of the essence, I think, of what people are looking for as some organizations are rethinking their EEO or DEI or whatever you want to call it. They're rethinking those programs, not to get rid of them, but to say, let's take a fresh look and make this policy really work. If you're talking to people about how to create a great program for assuring that everybody has an opportunity, what would you say some of the keys are?
I think some of the keys are getting people in the pipeline. I was deeply offended when we would have to defend a case where the manager felt, well, I need to add a Black or a Hispanic on my staff. So if one makes the cert, that's who I'm going to pick, without any consideration of who was the best qualified. And that was extremely annoying to me because it really undermined the whole concept of equity, of DEI, and it caused a resentment by non-minority persons feeling that, well, they just picked him or her because of their race or because of their gender. Oh, the gender is a big one, too, because of their gender or because that person has a disability and they wanted to check that box on their performance when they put in for their performance review. I found that very disturbing. And so what I would tell them, start getting people in the pipeline early on. Go to high schools. Have people from your professional speak and mentor people. You know, go to the colleges. Invite people to come for summer internship programs. Get people in the pipeline. Because once they're in the pipeline, you have the opportunity to observe their work ethic and how smart and how sharp they are. And then you can select them and do it in such a way that the peers won't feel that it was a DEIA hire. They will feel like, wow, you know, Bob picked the best person for the job because Michelle is phenomenal. I work with her 2 summers in a row. She is really impressive. And that's what I would encourage people. You can't start plucking people when it's time to try to diversify your staff. You got to get people in the pipeline. And I see that as a real shortcoming for a lot of organizations. They're not getting people in the pipeline.
I think that's
that
really
question,
good advice. Yeah, it okay. Does. That is one of the keys. I think another key is if you're redoing these kind of programs is you listen to your people. Because issues vary from place to place, and it's partly understanding who feels like they're not included, what's going on, what are the issues here. So partly, it has to start with some self-observation for some organizations. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. And if you don't have people in the room, then you make huge mistakes.
Yeah.
Huge mistakes. One recent that comes to mind is the Adidas commercial where they have a shoe from 1972 in the ad for the Olympics where they didn't realize that there were Jewish athletes that were murdered in the 1972 Olympics. And they're celebrating that shoe. Somebody missed it.
Yeah.
Somebody wasn't in the room. Somebody wasn't in the room. And so when you do things like that, I'm like, who was making the decisions? You've got to have people in the room because inevitably you're going to make a horrible decision. And it's hard to come back from those bad decisions. It's very difficult. You know, people can be very unforgiving.
Yeah. I think it's listening is such a huge part of leadership. And this is one area where it's really important. Well, changing gears again, let's look at the career paths of some of our listeners who might be Gen Z, or they're in college, or they're young professionals. Things have changed since when you and I were starting out, but still, there are lots of opportunities where people are not treated well or don't know where to begin. One of the things we've talked about is the importance of reaching out and connecting. Do you have any other suggestions for people who are in the workplace and yet they're feeling not included in the opportunities? What are some keys to kind of working through that situation?
Well, first of all, I would encourage young people, take any assignment they give you, large or small, take it, do it well. Trust me, they will see you. They will see you. You can feel like, well, they're not really even appreciating all the great work I'm doing. Yes, they are. They will see you. And then I would really encourage you to ask for don't ask for an hour or a half an hour. Ask for a 10-minute meeting with the leaders, various leaders in your organization. Go into the meeting with questions prepared, informing them of what your goals are, and ask them if they could give you one suggestion as to something you should do to move ahead in the organization. One question. Don't go in there with 10 questions. They don't have time for 10. And trust me, one of those people is going to say, you know, I met with that Nicole last week, and she was impressive. And they'll speak to your supervisor. How is she doing down there? And the supervisor say, well, she works hard. And the person say, well, you know, I'd like to tap her for some task force that I'm setting up, or I want to tap her to do this assignment or that assignment. You really have got to come to the attention of the leadership. And that's through hard work and then asking them questions so that you stand out from everybody else. I would recommend that.
That is really good advice. That it's sometimes when you're discouraged, it's hard to do the hard work. It's hard to keep trying. But you are an example of somebody who just, you know, kept working on the tasks and went past barrier after barrier after barrier. And it can be done.
It absolutely can be done. I was supposed to, when I inherited the then Civil Rights Division at USDA, the division was created out of a report that found that the Office of the General Counsel was not sensitive to the issues of Black farmers. And there was a report called the CRAT report, C-R-A-T. And I think it stood for Civil Rights Action Team or Action Task Force. And the CRAT report came up with a number of suggestions as to how the Department of Agriculture could treat Black farmers better, could do better for the Black farmer community. And one of the things was they felt very strongly that the lawyers in OGC were not compassionate, were not sensitive to the issues of Black farmers. And so they created the Civil Rights Division in 1999 under President Clinton. And at that time, it had 7 attorneys, 1 admin, and 1 supervisor. 9 people. And when I took the job as the Associate General Counsel of the Civil Rights Division in 2001, I grew that division from nine people to almost 40. The division has 32, 33 attorneys, currently 5 admin support and 5 supervisors. And so, you know, they said I couldn't do it. But when people tell you you can't, let me say this. For me, I dig my heels in and I want to prove them wrong. I am a very spiritual person, so I pray, so I know that I can't do anything. Now, I don't beat people over the head with a Bible, but for me, prayer is the key to my success. You know, I would call my mother, "Mom, it's so hard, it's so hard." And she said, "Baby, with God, all things are possible and nothing is impossible." And so that's how I carry myself. So I got up. People used to laugh at me. It was so funny. I got up every morning at 6 and I would be in the office by 6:30. I would literally be at USDA by 6:30. And when I pulled up to the guard station, because I executive parking, you know, security, you have, I would always have some gospel song blasting in the background, Yolanda Adams or somebody blasting in the background. And the guard would say, "Here comes Miss Leland." And I would pull in there. I'd get out the car and I'd go upstairs and I'd go to my office. And I would go in my office 6:30 in the morning, blasting gospel, because the staff didn't get there until 8, blasting my gospel in the background. And there was an attorney next door to me. It was Gary Frimmerin, I think it's Frimmerin, next to me. And he would say, I would go over and say, "Is this music too loud for you?" He said, "No, I find it." This is a white man from a major law firm who had just come to OGC. Uh-huh. He said, "No, Arlene, I find it very soothing." Gary Frimmerman, he said, "I find it very soothing." And so I did that 6:30 in the morning to 7 at night. I left USDA at between 7 and 7:30 every night. I would get home at 8 because I knew I had to start all over the next day. And I worked like that for 2 solid years. People could not believe it because I wasn't going to fail. I didn't have enough staff, so I had to be a working manager. I had a caseload. But as I continued to shine, they gave me more staff. The client said, "Arlene Leland needs more staff." And so the general counsel, whether they liked it or not, they had to give me more staff. And so, you know, that's it's hard work. I go back to the very basics here. And that is, have you ever heard of VISA? Vision, integrity, structure, and accountability.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I go back to. I carry it with me everywhere. Some people don't leave home without their American Express. I didn't leave home without my Visa.
Uh-huh. 'Cause
I knew I had to maintain each of those letters. And one of the attorneys on my staff, because I would preach it at every staff meeting, "Remember, Visa, vision, vision, integrity, structure, accountability." And one of my attorneys, Marissa Suarez, I'll never forget, she said, "Well, I think it's VISTA." And I looked at her and she said, "Teamwork, vision, integrity, structure, teamwork, and accountability." So I thought to myself, yeah, Marissa, you're right. There should be a T in there for teamwork as well. But
oh, that's great.
That's where I come from.
Arlene, you, I know, are an inspiration to many, many people. And by the way, I'm one of them. Your spirit and determination and your willingness to see both sides of any issue are remarkable. But now you're at kind of a new phase in your life after this long slog and high achieving career. You have retired. You're kind of creating a portfolio of other activities. But let me ask, in the years to come. What do you want as the kind of the part of the your portfolio career going forward? And by career, I mean just all the things you do. What are the elements that, that you're working into your life as you're thinking about your next phase?
Mediation and consulting. I want to bring sides together that are they are in a situation where they're disagreeing. And I want to bring them together and I want them to listen to each other and hopefully work out a resolution. I think it's so important that people hear each other. Right now in this country, we don't hear each other. We don't hear each other. And, you know, if we don't start listening to each other and hearing each other, you know, a divided house cannot stand. And so I am optimistic that people will at some point decide, well, maybe I'll listen to what Arlene has to say. I don't have to agree with her, but I want to listen to what she has to say. And I will say to a person, you know, I don't agree with you, but you bring some legitimate points to the discussion that warrant my consideration. That's what I want to do. I want to consult with companies, organizations about how they can do their employee engagement better. You know, I find that a happy employee is a productive employee. An appreciated employee is a treasure, someone to be treasured and honored and valued. I had colleagues tell me, Arlene, you're too nice to your staff. Well, every year I took my staff out for a holiday lunch and I allowed each of them to invite a partner, whether it was their spouse, their best friend. You know, not everybody's married. Not everybody's a childless cat lady. And so I would invite people to bring their spouse, their partner, their best friend, their bestie, their homie. And I would take them out to lunch. I didn't say, well, you can only have off the lunch menu and you can only have the special of the day. And, you know, I wanted people to enjoy themselves. And so my colleagues would say, why are you doing that? And then I would give everybody, all of the staff, a holiday gift. And I say holiday because I had a number of people on my staff who were Hindu and Jewish. And so I wanted to make sure it was a holiday celebration. It was not a Christmas celebration. I had to check people on that. It's a holiday celebration. I mean, I just think that you should show people that you appreciate the relationship, the collaboration, the partnership, their hard work. My tagline on my email for years was working together work. You know, working together does work. And if you're not working together, you're not going to be able to be successful.
Well, I look forward to see what you do next. I know you have so much to offer, and I think whatever you do is going to be pretty interesting. Arlene, thank you so much for being here today and kind of sharing your story. I knew that you wouldn't have any trouble thinking of things to tell us because you are one of the best storytellers I know. It's always fun to be with you, and I hope it was really enjoyable for our listeners today too. So thank you.
Can I mention one thing before I go? Because sure. I always want to show appreciation. And if they happen to be listening, I want to thank Dr. Penny Brown Reynolds, the Acting Assistant Secretary for the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at USDA. I want to thank Kevin Shea, who is the special advisor, senior advisor to Secretary Vilsack and to the Deputy Secretary. And I want to thank Stephen Brammer, who is the new Associate General Counsel for Civil Rights, Labor, and Employment Law Division. The three of those persons and Janie Hipp, the former General Counsel, who left me for a year. She left in July of 2023. But I want to thank those persons for just enriching my life. I want to thank Charlie Rawls, who was my mentor, and John Golden, who was also my mentor. Three white men, Barton Whittam, Charlie Rawls, John Golden. Thank you very much, Beverly, for having me.
All right. Well, have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Today, we've been talking with Arlene Leland about building a thriving career shaped by hard work and strong values. This podcast is produced by WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our audio engineer. I'm your host, Beverly Jones, author of Think Like an Entrepreneur, Act Like a CEO. And our sponsor is the Voinovich School of Leadership and Public Service at Ohio University. Today's tip is that if you're facing serious career barriers, don't just give up. Working hard, despite all the hassle, can take you to a better place. Thanks for listening, and if you enjoyed today's show, please tell your friends.